Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, June 26th, 2001. In the fireside room this evening is John Marty. Today's session is entitled Citizen Lobbying, Making an Impact in Politics. Let's listen in.
A session on how to make an impact on the political process as a citizen, citizen lobbying. I'm John Marty, a state senator from Minnesota and interested in the issue, and I think this is the kind of one that people may have a lot of questions on and a lot of, I don't know which direction we'll go. So I'd like to start out by sort of framing the issue the way I see it and then figure it might be more a question-answer type of thing than some other ones, because people often, I've been trying this kind of approach and does this make any kind of a difference whatsoever? But when we talk about the concept of having an impact in government, obviously, in a democracy of the government, of the people, you, the people, are supposed to have the impact, and as being in a country of getting closer to 300 million people, just because you think something's a good idea doesn't mean it's going to become law. And obviously the bigger the unit of government, I mean a city, town council with 30 people in the town, you probably have a lot better chance of influencing public policy in the town than you do in a community of 300,000, and certainly more than in a country of 300 million people. And obviously some people would perhaps cynically say, well, you can't influence government without a lot of clout and a lot of money anyhow, so what difference does it make? Unfortunately, it's often true that the people with the best organized, most powerful, most money groups tend to have more clout than others do. But obviously, people who care about issues want to try and have an impact on whether it's local or state or federal government, and hence the reason for trying to have an impact as a citizen lobbyist. In framing the issue, I guess I'd see two types of ways you can change the way government decisions are made. One of which is by influencing or determining who becomes the decision maker. And number two, influencing the people who are making the decisions. In determining who becomes the decision maker, that's obviously the simplest, most basic level in a democracy is voting. You vote for people you think should hold office, people you agree with, you share their values or their judgment. But obviously, that's a entry-level kind of thing. It's not the way you're going to have the most impact. The more active, the more aggressive you can be in terms of choosing who the decision makers are, the more likely you are to be satisfied with what you have. So if you want to do more than just voting, obviously, helping elect the people you want has a chance to do this. Whether that's by helping out in the campaign, whether it's by volunteering, contributing, simply word of mouth, talking with friends and explaining, you know, this candidate is really good on whatever issues, whatever concerns, whatever your reason for supporting them, talking with friends and trying to persuade others to do it outside of the campaign, just on your own. Or for that matter, trying to change the broader public opinion, letters to the editor, other means you have of doing that. And obviously, the more you get involved in the campaigns, the more you have a chance to influence who becomes the decision maker, and probably the ultimate one is decide you're fed up with what's happening, you want to run for office yourself, or you want to encourage somebody else who's never run for office who you think would be good for that. And it's amazing how many candidates, especially for local offices, are talked into it. You'd be good for this. You'd be, like your judgment, like the way you think. I think it's often people who have been active, maybe some school board issue or city council or state legislative issue. They've been active in some cause, some group of issues, and some friends who see that say, you know, you could do a lot better job than whoever the person in office is. Why don't you consider running? All of those, again, are in the framework of trying to influence who becomes the decision maker. And obviously, If you take the legislature this year in Minnesota, and virtually every state's the same thing, you're dealing with hundreds of issues on every conceivable area, and you're not going to find somebody who you agree with on every single issue. I mean, it's highly unlikely that any two people are going to agree on every issue. So you end up working for people who presumably, when people talk about the lesser of two evils, it's pretty hard to get inspired to work for somebody you don't care about at all. But I have one constituent who's been involved in my campaign since the beginning, since I first ran. He works very hard and helps out in lots of ways, and I know we've had some very strongly felt conversations which we disagree on certain issues. Most recent one is sports stadiums. He believes the state should be involved in funding that, and I don't. He feels that's probably one of his the issue I've heard from him more than any other issue in the last 5, 6, 7 years, and I know he feels extremely strongly about it. And despite a strong disagreement on that, I think I have to say that he's continued to, I mean, I'm hesitant to ask him to volunteer in my campaign because I know how strongly he feels about the issue, but he keeps doing it because on balance, he thinks I'm better legislator than who would be running against me, and he feels strong enough about that to put a lot of work into. So you try and recognizing that unless you run for office yourself, you're probably not going to agree on every issue with the person who you may be supporting. Obviously, the second way of having an influence is dealing with those people in office, the people who are making the decisions. Not always is that elected officials, it's often appointed officials. One example of that in most states, public utilities commissions, the people who set rates and policies for telephone, energy, electric, gas types of utilities are not elected people. They're usually appointed in most states, and yet they have a lot of clout. And there are a lot of people, environmental groups, energy groups, business groups, others who are always trying to influence them. And basically influencing them works in many ways the same as elected officials, other than there may be only so much pressure you can put on someone who's not accountable to the voters at some point. And the best way, I think the best way to have an impact on elected officials is to try and persuade them. Persuade them by providing them information they didn't have before. You know more about the issue than somebody else. Well, frankly, a lot of people do know more. Someone who's an engineer may know more about certain engineering issues that may have relate to some public energy code types of policy than somebody else, than the decision makers, but providing information, new information particularly with that, but also appealing, not just to, I've got some new information you've never heard, did you know this? It's amazing how many times people are convinced they've got some extremely persuasive argument because of course you've never heard the issue, the information. So you're not always going to be there with some new information. And that's not the only way you try and persuade somebody. You persuade them, the more passionate you are about the issue, the more strongly you feel about it, perhaps the better you'll be at, as long as you can control your, as long as you're not beating them over the head and can't shut up when it's time to be quiet. Letting them know how strongly you feel about something is not a bad thing to do. You can appeal to their compassion, to their empathy, to their understanding. And telling them particular perspectives you have is a big part of it. That's a sort of new information they may have. If you want them to know how this type of tax bill or education thing or something else affects you or somebody you know, that can be very powerful, and it's information that should influence the way they look at some issue. The second way outside of persuasion, and this is a little more touchy, but perhaps it's done subtly in ways that may be very effective, and that's by pressure. Perhaps the subtle fear that you don't want to take this stand on the issue because you've got tens of thousands of constituents who strongly disagree with you on that, that may have a lot of impact. There's ways you can overstep that and have it be counterproductive, but the pressure. letting people know that you and many other people feel strongly about the issue. And the more you have to tell them, I and every member of my family and everybody I talk to feel strongly about this issue, isn't as likely to have an impact as if they hear a letter from you and they get a letter from them and they hear from somebody else, they hear from a lot of people, they may get the sense that there's a lot of people. You telling them that, boy, I and my family and everybody else that I know of feel strongly about this, well, they may have a better sense of where the public is than any individual constituent is. So again, it can backfire if you're trying to bluster about how everybody feels strongly about it and they know opposite of that. Well, if you are trying to influence both the who becomes the decision maker and how they take off, how they make decisions once they do it, well, the two basic ways that you can do that are obviously as an individual or multiply your efforts, do it as a group. And speak first about the idea of how individuals lobby and then how, why there's advantages to doing it in a broader manner by having lots of people do it. First of all, what to communicate. And my list of suggestions here would involve a lot of what not to do. The first of which is telling the politician what they think and why you disagree with that isn't very effective. I've gotten so many letters over the years, somebody tell me, I know you believe this and this and this, and you're just dead wrong and so on. Well, it's amazing how many times they don't have a clue what you believe. They're clueless about it, and they're telling you what you believe, and of course they lose credibility pretty quickly then. You know that they're angry at something that they shouldn't be angry at because they don't even disagree. Or they know they disagree with you on two other issues, and therefore, or your party, or whatever, they disagree with you on one thing or some other things, and therefore you're some evil person. Why do they bother to write the letter? I mean, you do this, some guy wrote me a nasty letter a few months ago about how I can't do anything right and so on, and, but maybe this time you'll do the right thing and vote for such and such. That's really a positive way to get somebody to see your way. And I was going to say the threatening letters. It's amazing how many letters I get every year. And I think with one exception, every re-election campaign I've gotten more votes than the previous one. But how many people, I voted for you every time, but boy, if you vote for this thing, I'm never going to support you again. Or they say, I used to support you, but I don't anymore because of this. You know, there are some people, if there's one individual who had helped in all my campaigns and is now in the last 4, 5, 6 years, made it clear that his number one issue we disagree on, I would probably believe him if he said he used to support me and he's not doing it anymore. But usually it's the people who, I've worked hard, I've told everybody to do this, and now me and my entire family. I always like to say, I know a lot of families where spouses and others don't agree on all the issues. But when they tell you how they used to be a strong supporter of yours, it's amazing how many times you can go back in your files and look at old letters from them and they weren't very much of a supporter. But threatening and being nasty and again, when most incumbents in most places tend to win by larger margins. I was going to say in the U.S. Congress, I can't picture more than 5 to 10% of races being anything near competitive. And I think it's unfortunate, but I mean, there are times when there's a 98% re-election rate of incumbents, which is a separate issue. But the point is, going in there and threatening them, if you don't do this, we're going to work hard to defeat you. Again, one guy who I know is, he's chaired my opponent's campaign and so on before. He once sent me a letter about how if you don't change your view on this, I'm going to do everything in my power to defeat you. I thought, he's already done that. So again, the whole thing, if you're going to try and suggest, you know, you're really disappointed in this, I've always liked you and supported you in this, don't overstate your case because it's often pretty obvious. Politicians may not have everything you got going for them, but a whole lot of them are pretty sophisticated about what a phony thing is. And with that, I mean, I was going to say more and more groups have these phony grassroots, I think I've heard them called AstroTurf. It's not really grass, it's AstroTurf lobbying, where groups now send things. Our state budget is still up in the air, and a big fight over that, and people are really tense on all sides, and everybody's angry at everybody. And one of the parties started a phone bank calling in certain legislators and just call after call after call. I want this done, and I want it done now, in their position on the issue. And staff was saying that, oh yeah, they asked people, because were no calls one day, next day you start getting 30, 40, 50 calls on an issue that for the last week you may have gotten two calls on, all on the same position, all the same message. Is this from a phone bank? Well, some people would just, no, this is just me. But others would say, and I mean, when you get 30, 40, 50 calls and the staff starts asking them all, half of them say, well, yeah, so-and-so called me, this party called me and asked me, told me that I should do this. And in, at one point they even said, oh yeah, so the, all these, if I was willing to call, then they just plug my call through. They connect you. You know, that often shows through, and people kind of figure out if you have no mail on something and the next day you start getting heavy mail on it, it's usually somebody's organized to do it, and sometimes they don't feel that strong. I was going to say, what do you do? Well, provide information. And information may not be some new facts, it may be a new perspective. It may be how this affects you, why it's a problem, why you're concerned about it. Certainly, if it's something that doesn't affect you directly, but you know others who are really affected in a negative way or a positive way by something, that can have more cost. I mean, it's kind of like not somebody trying to do something for their own sake, but because they think it's the right thing to do to help somebody else. That can be particularly powerful, but provide information and the reasons you favor and oppose. It's amazing how many, please vote no on Senate file such and such so and so. And they don't even tell what the issue is. I mean, they were told that this is the bill number, they want you to know they know the bill number, and please vote no on this, and you gotta have, I don't know, the bill number of every bill. Most bills I don't, except for the ones I'm working on or whatever. If you ask me the big budget bills that we're considering right now in our legislature, I couldn't tell you the numbers. But somebody tells you, please vote for this, you gotta look up the number, figure out what bill it is, what they're concerned about. That doesn't tell you much. It tells you that one person thinks you ought to be in favor or opposed to a bill, but no reasons. Give some reasons. Why do you think it's a bad thing? I mean, especially in a lot of bigger bills in most state legislatures, there are a lot of things together, especially budget bills. You may have 40 things. Please favor this. Well, it may have 100 items, and you may have a chance to help with the one item they want, and they may oppose other parts of it. Provide information on what you favor and oppose and why. In other words, he's explicit about it. If it's something, if you support a bill, if you think you like this concept, I really want you to do something about, Eastern Washington, the Hanford nuclear waste dump. You want to do something about that. Explain what you want done and say, but you know, I'm really concerned that what's going to happen here is more of a sham. It's not really going to address the issue. And I really hope that rather than do this or this or this, I hope you do nothing and fix it right next year. Explain your position. It doesn't have to take pages to do that. It might be two sentences, but explain where you're coming from. The concerns you have, let them know your passion for the issue. I said, how do you communicate? How is the best way to get this information out? Well, the more visible you are, the more impact you are going to have. A personal visit. If you live anywhere near a state capital or something, and most state legislators in all but the biggest states like California have, you can reach them at home. If you live 300 miles from the state capital, I mean, you got to watch about intruding in people's lives, but a lot of local legislators will say, yeah, if you want to talk to them, call them at home and you have a chance to talk with them, express your concerns either in person or by phone. In smaller states, or if you live close to the capital, contacting them at the capital is often a local call. But personal visits make a real impact when you sit down and talk to somebody face to face. Certainly calls, letters, emails, all of them can have their own strengths and weaknesses. Other than one thing about emails, I think the numbers I've seen from the U.S. Senate now are how many million they get per month now. And a whole lot of people, they learned, hey, I can have impact. I can write all 100 senators and all 435 House members, and I can just blast fax, blast email it. Takes 2 minutes for my computer. I enter all the addresses in. And I'm going to please vote no or yes on this. They're getting so much of it, it's just they're snowed under. They don't have the staff to go through these and do that. So people are getting responses that are pretty blank. Pretty thanks for letting us know your concerns about whatever issue you can contact us about. It'll make a real difference. But emails, if you do, let them know your address. I mean, I get emails from people with whatever kind of clever email address name they have. You don't have a clue if they're from your state, let alone your district. People who are from your district tend to put their addresses on. We just get so many emails now that you can't possibly deal with all of them. The ones that have addresses on and are from the district are more likely to have an impact. And again, blast emailing everybody may have some slight benefit, I suppose, the state legislative level or county commissioner level or something, but I wouldn't oversell it. And when you're doing this, the more work you put into communicating, probably the more impact you're going to have. If you do the real touching personal ones, dear Senator, fill in the blank, I feel strongly about such and such and so, sincerely fill in the blank, and they're all orange postcards which get more attention, and they all come from the same address, and you filled out this thing at some table at some event, and they pick them all up and then they deliver them to the Capitol. Boy, they took a lot of time to put those things in, and what you're going to get is a form letter back. If we get 120 postcards, all of them identical, we're going to send out 120 identical letters. They may think they were all hand-done and they got a personal one. I read their postcard and thought, well, I should tell this person so-and-so. But basically, it may have some impact because, wow, there are a lot of people who feel this way. Though with some groups very sophisticated in doing it, it may not have as much impact as it would have once upon a time. But you get, in state legislative office, you may have 10, 15 letters on an issue may begin to get people attention that you figure for every one who wrote, maybe there are 100 people who feel strongly about the issue. But certainly when you write personal letters, and nowadays I even think there are times when it might be advantageous to handwrite a letter if your writing is legible because people know you can't have done that on the computer. But even so, even if it's typed and so on, it doesn't hurt to do it and do that and put a pencil, a note at the bottom, it doesn't hurt either. And frankly, it's not a dumb idea to ask a question or two. Instead of saying, I strongly support this and this and hope you'll vote for this because of this reason, you say, do you think this makes sense or do you have other arguments? I'd be happy to hear your arguments on how you feel about it. Or would you be willing to do this? Ask a question or two. It's a little more of a headache for the person getting the mail because they have to respond to the question you ask, but you at least get a sense then whether they're at least hearing your message or whether you write on one issue and they write back on something that's vaguely related to the subject matter, and you get the sense they didn't even hear what you had to say, and then firing off an immediate letter saying, look, I wrote you about this. I got a letter back about this. Did you read my letter? Here's why I feel strongly. And usually there's enough egg on their face at that time that they will at least spend more time paying attention to it and so on. But the more work you put into it, the more response you're likely to get, the more it's likely to have an impact on them. And again, sometimes one letter of expressing concern about the way some health insurance issue is handled, whether something's covered by it, sometimes you're not asking for a big broader public policy change, but you want to know why it is a certain way. It might just be something that was messed up. Somebody wasn't following the law or doing something improper, a mistake happened. And sometimes you can get some help in intervening with that and finding out the law was fine. Somebody just did something wrong. So in one letter, I've had times when I've introduced a bill based on information I got in one letter. So it can have an impact that way. Again, the more efforts you do, if you write a letter, follow up with a phone call, say I just sent you a letter yesterday, don't know that you received it yet, but I hope you can take a look at this. Two contacts from the same person on the same issue might draw attention to it. The more you can do to follow up on something, the better. Or you write the letter saying, I'll call your office next week and we'd love to have a chance to talk with you for 10 minutes. That's more likely to do it too. In all of this, being sensitive of time is pretty important. Somebody who has to, you're their legislator, you're their congressperson, and therefore they have a right to your time, is at a certain point can be insensitive. I think most people, U.S. Senator, gubernatorial level in bigger states, they can't possibly, if you represent 5 million people, or many times that in California, you can't really talk individually to each constituent for as long as they want to talk to you. There just isn't the time. You'd have no time to do anything other than talk with them. And frankly, your job is to hear from the public what their concerns are and try and do the best you can to represent them. But I was going to suggest that you be sensitive to the time, however you do it. And often, if you say, I'd only like 3 minutes to talk with you about this, or talk with a staff person in a bigger constituency, talk with a legislator staff person. I want 3 minutes, 5 minutes. Boy, that's a lot more thrilling than somebody who wants a half-hour appointment. You can deal with a lot more that way, and you probably have more success if you can keep your time concise. Building ties is another nice thing to do. All of these things work good as an individual, they work the same as a group. As I mentioned earlier, I had a talk yesterday or whenever on money and politics, contributors seem to get more attention paid to it. And I'm not saying just contributors, but that's human nature. Contributors, volunteers, supporters, people who they know, people who public officials know, they're human beings. If somebody's nice to you, you tend to be nice to them in return. Again, I think at least some public officials, some might feel the opposite of the way I do, but I think there are at least some public officials who get really feeling disgusted if they think the only reason you worked for them was so that they could persuade you how to vote on a certain issue. So you'd have their ear. Had people who I've chased away from my office who, good friend, here's a contribution, and boy, I hope you can do this and hope you can support this. I don't want to tie any of that together, and I don't like that, and I think it's wrong, and there are some public officials who will be really offended if you do that. Some might love it, but I was going to say they might like it better if they sense you really care about them and their campaigns and you support them. But getting to know somebody, either as a volunteer or just as a constituent, and saying, I'm really concerned about this and I'd like to talk to you. The closer the tie you build, the more they're likely to hear what you have to say. And again, building trust and goodwill. If you are working intensely on, let's say, an environmental issue you care strongly about and you're trying to deal with with elected officials on it, the more they see you providing poor information, misinformation, whatever else, the more they lose your trust. The nastier you are, the more you're going to lose the goodwill. The more you can build a trust and goodwill, the more likely they are to be willing to spend time with you, to listen to you, hear your concerns. Now, finally, before opening it up for questions and so on, in discussion, I was going to say similar things work together in groups. Groups can multiply the impact. One letter gets lost in the shuffle. Thousands of letters can make a real impact. For the world, the group that works on the hunger issues, World Hunger Issues, they've, despite having a less than sympathetic federal government to their concerns, have had a real impact over the years just because of the sheer number of people who write letters. You talk to a lot of congressional offices, oh yes, this is one of their issues. We've been getting a lot of mail on that. It certainly raises an issue that otherwise would not get attention, and the group can have a real impact. And they focus their efforts on educating their members, urging them to do this. Lots of groups, whether they're education or business or labor or environment or whatever kinds of issues, groups can provide one of the best reasons for linking up with groups. It's not just because there's power in numbers, but because most of us don't have time in the day to pay attention to everything that's going on in government. And frankly, if there's somebody there who, if you're a member of a group that shares some similar concerns to you, they will be tracking this, following it more. They can provide information to you. And with that, you'll have a better sense of when you should contact somebody. Just writing somebody saying, I'm concerned about homelessness and hope you'll do something about it out of the blue, may not have the same kind of impact as it will if they're contacting you at a time when there's an issue related to that coming up in their level of government. And I was going to say that in both the individual and the group kind of setting, what you're trying to do is work to promote, if you're trying to persuade government to do something, you're working, you've got some idea, some concern, and there are a number of ways you can do that. Again, from as groups, you can do the same things as individuals in supporting candidates. Some groups make endorsements of candidates. Some of them do question answer things and print up what the candidates respond to them on. I don't care for the yes, no ones when they phrase the questions a certain way so much as the ones where they say, you know, it's a pain in the neck to fill out, but it's more helpful to people. Can you give us 100 words on how you feel about this issue? Give somebody. I mean, I had one where they gave you 35 words per question. I mean, how do you feel we should deal with tax policy on such and such? 35 words, you try it. But you know, even though we might say 100 words is pretty limiting in some ways too, a lot of questionnaires will have 75 to 200, 300 words on each of several questions. And I know I spend a lot of time trying to give rational answers, not just to newspaper ones and League of Women Voter ones, but to certain other ones as well, to spell out where you stand. And I think that those groups educate their own members that way. They get answers from candidates, and some of the groups may be more fair about this than others, but trying to get legitimate answers from groups, from candidates, in a whole range of races, and League of Women Voters is a resource in most states where they try and do voters' guides, and they do not endorse candidates, they don't favor candidates, they just want to provide information out there. And there are similar groups nationwide now that are trying to have internet sites where you answer these questions and so on. And it's, I don't know how many people use them, but it is very helpful for those who do want to. Groups can do that. They can be supportive of candidates in the media and with the public. Again, trying the same thing. And finally, in wrapping this up, in trying to appeal to changed public policy, you don't just have to appeal to the decision maker. You can also appeal to the broader public. Letters to the editor, trying to build support for something which will then indirectly have a bigger impact because it's going to change the public discourse, change the political climate on an issue. Several years ago when Minnesota dealt with a stadium funding issue and I felt strongly about it, I knew my colleagues didn't agree with me on it. I worked very aggressively and I think very successfully to get the public alert to it, and in September of 96 election, September of it, I suggested that the proponents were trying to keep it real quiet. I mean, they were. They made a couple of statements that nobody paid much attention to, saying how we're going to push this issue after November. Why after November? Well, there's an election before that. And I suggested, you know, if you care about the issue, speak out now. A month later, one of my colleagues said, you know, every candidate forum he was at, that was the first question asked. I try and do, when there's an issue I feel strongly about that I don't feel I can get success from appealing to my colleagues as a public official, I will appeal to the public in some ways, writing commentaries in the local papers, things like that. You can raise public discourse on an issue and public awareness of something. You don't have to be a public official to do that. Private citizens do it all the time. I'm really concerned about such and such issue, and if you're a good writer, you might write a lot of things to a lot of papers. I'm not sure that the people who write, who have letters to the editor in a local paper or something every 3 weeks, necessarily have the most credibility. People, oh, this guy's going on and on and on again. But certainly doing your attempt to appeal not just to the decision maker, but to the public. With that, that's the framework I'd like to do, but I think this is the kind of thing where people have tried things. Does this make any difference? Is this the way to go or not? So I'd like to open it up for, hear what the ideas or questions or suggestions are. Yes?
Very often outside of our grocery store or supermarket, there's somebody standing there with a petition they want you to sign. What kind of effect do those petitions that you might receive have on your opinion, or how are they treated when they reach your office?
I've seen times where, well, first of all, on petitions in general, I've seen a lot of cases where I get the sense that people sign a petition where, well, they did it to be polite. And I've heard a lot of public officials say signatures on a petition mean nothing. My first experience of that was in college when a bunch of students, we were trying to persuade the president of the school and others to change some policy. I don't have a clue what the issue was anymore, but I remember we were trying to change this. We had a bunch of signatures. And met with the president, presented him all this, and he said, you know, these signatures don't mean anything. I could carry out a petition with saying the opposite thing and get a whole lot of signatures too. And there is some truth to that. People sign a lot of things because, well, I guess I don't oppose it, and it sounds pretty good, and don't know anything about it. So don't oversell the value of a petition. It may have some impact. And the thing is, I've known a lot of politicians, and I myself would do it too. You get 300 signatures on something saying that I hope you'll do this, and it's something you agree with. Hey, I'm going to send them a letter telling them I agree with them. I'm not sure if it has a big impact or not. I'd say that most groups nowadays are trying to, the groups that used to have the petitions tend to have the cards that they send out, and dear Senator fill in the blank, which may have a little more impact, especially if they look like they had to mail these in on their own, and that takes a little more initiative. You get the sense somebody cared more about the issue. As a signature on a petition, legally in some states it makes a difference, a signature to get an issue on a ballot, other things like that, but one that we feel strongly about this issue, I don't think it has a lot of impact any more than our legislature often passes resolutions to Congress urging them not to do something or another on some foreign policy issue or something else. And I always thought, you know, I'm sure there's this file cabinet somewhere in Washington and some file clerk is getting this, oh my, the Minnesota Senate feels strongly about this. Okay, I'll put it in this file drawer here. I'm not sure that citizen petitions tend to do much more than that. I've seen some very cleverly done ones, and they get 10,000, 20,000 names. People might take notice just because of the size of it, but usually the way they get the attention is going to the media. We got 20,000 signatures on this issue, and sometimes it may be the media play on it, maybe more dramatic. I've seen some where they sign it and they staple these things, they have hundreds of yards of signatures on petitions on something. So in other words, it's the presentation of it more than how many names are on it. But, yes?
How about demonstrators at the Capitol? How do you feel they being affected?
Demonstrators at the Capitol, I guess they could have a positive impact, they could have a negative impact. A few years ago, one of my colleagues had some guy protesting an issue, threw a cream pie in the face of this legislator, which maybe good slapstick humor and so on, but it happened to be on a stairway, and she's an older woman, and she fell and kind of hurt herself a little bit, and the guy was charged with assault and everything else. And just to show how that it was not a positive impact, this guy was recently hired as an organizer for a neighborhood organization in St. Paul, and he was the city council found out that this was the guy who had thrown this pie, and they were debating whether to cut off city funding for the neighborhood group, and the group decided not to hire the guy. I think there was bipartisan feeling this guy, people who may have agreed with his cause, a whole lot of the groups who were supporting the same cause he was were sending apology letters. This has nothing to do with we do it. We don't do anything like that. That's obviously a minor pie in the face, in my mind, is not the most major assault, but I mean, the guy injured her in the process unwittingly. But demonstrators, we have more and more. We have sometimes on issues like the abortion issue, you have two sides holding big posters on each side of the thing, each side of the stairway going into the chamber. There's one group in Minnesota that is very vocal, and they scream and holler and protest, and I think it has a negative impact. They're irritating, and people are angry at them, and so some demonstrations do. You can show support. If you can get 5,000 people out in Capitol steps or in the rotunda, that may make an impact. Nasty rallies or other things, a demonstration that's not in your face can have an impact, especially then they'll have 600 seniors coming to talk about prescription drugs. Then they'll break into groups and each go meet with their own legislators. And those can have a lot more positive impact, or sheer numbers if somebody can have an overwhelming number of people. But demonstrations can also, again, can get out of hand, and people, they can backfire. So, yes?
Well, I just had a comment on the other, not petitions, but is a letter signed by 10 people or 20 people still just one letter versus a letter for one person?
It might have a little more impact if they all put their addresses on and so on. You get the sense that they felt...
It was an obviously individualized, composed letter.
Yeah. There are 10 of us here, and we feel very strongly about this thing. Rather than write you 10 letters, we were talking, our group of us feel strongly about this. I think that would have a little more impact than one person, and frankly, a lot of sometimes people figure, ooh, there are 10 people there, I better respond to this one. I think it would have more impact than one person signing one letter. It may not have as much as if all 10 wrote letters, but... It's again, unfortunately, well, it's true in a lot of things in life. The more effort you put into it, the more result you tend to get. Yes?
Well, I was, demonstrators. In Minnesota, the college students demonstrated for the education.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a big fair in the Capitol. And they were just there for one reason. I don't think they were violent, but just present.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make a difference or not in the votes?
It may. Again, we have the public higher education institutions. We have the private college students came in. And again, they try and organize this. They're getting more and more, everybody's getting more sophisticated. They realize government has a lot of say in things that affect them. They try and do their stuff to have the greatest impact. When the private colleges come around, they make sure that students at the colleges that certain legislators went to get visited from those students. I had visits from St. Olaf College, where I went, and certainly from the schools, a couple of schools that in or near my district, or people who are students who are constituents who were there. They try and make sure they have a big rally, they make a lot of noise, and if they make a lot of noise for a short period of time and so on, when their meeting's going on, that's one thing, but if it's the ones who are trying to disrupt, that's probably negative. But most of these groups don't try to disrupt, they realize that. And by then, channeling them around to make sure they make visits to several offices. Again, the ones from the college I went to they'll go to any legislator who has any ties with it. The legislators represent the community around the college, plus anyone who has any ties to the school. Sometimes they'll have, if the legislator didn't, but their spouse did, or their kid goes there, boy, they'll hit you on all those things. And yes, they can be very sophisticated. But if it's a rally of 200 people or so, there are those happening every day. So it helps. A lot of legislators wouldn't have a clue. Who's that down in the rotunda? I don't know, some group. If they make rounds of all the offices and just say, we had a rally in the rotunda, here's what our concern is. They stop in each office and talk for a couple minutes, especially those where they may have some reason for contact. I'd say that helps. Again, it's a personal visit. Even if they're not your constituent, you may pay attention to it.
Well, I was wondering if they do it sometimes for the media or the legislature, like the colleges, obviously got a lot of press.
Yeah.
Some don't get a lot of press all the time. And that's why I asked you, you know, the question, what's going on? And it's partly because the media has really carried it from the demonstrators or, you know, so on.
And that's the thing I was going to say. Some of the groups where there's a couple of people in the group who are angry or trying to obstruct something or another, sometimes the media likes that. There may be 500 people at a rally who are being well-behaved and trying to present their case, and two people there who are rowdy and troublemakers. It can backfire on them. Of course, the media is going to pay attention to the troublemakers. That's the news in their mind. But there are lots of the groups that focus on how to make a difference. The Minnesota Senior Federation came in on prescription drugs. They had some dummy pill prescription jars that are 6 feet tall by 3 feet wide. It was a clever gimmick, and the TV cameras tend to be out there, and they're aiming for coverage on the TV news because they know they might have a bigger impact that way. And then, of course, they'll make the rounds of the offices and talk to people anyhow. So they try and combine it. Some are aimed at the media. Having 300 people show up in the rotunda and say, we care about such and such thing for nursing home care, nursing home policy or something, we feel strongly about this, may get no media attention, and if they don't go to offices, nobody will know they were even there. But I think most of the groups are getting more sophisticated. They try and appeal either to the legislators directly or to the media or to both. And all of those can make an impact. Yes?
If I'm at the Capitol and I'm talking to a group of legislators other than my district, and I end up with a few extra minutes, is it appropriate for me to go to my district's representative and just
definitely
here on certain things?
If you are there, even if it's, supposing it's to testify an issue, if you're involved in education, have something about some curriculum issue or something that a legislature is dealing with, you go and speak to a committee, you testify before a committee, then you go and say, you know, I was just testifying down here, I'm a constituent of Representative so-and-so, and I just wanted to stop by and say hello while I'm here at the Capitol, let you know what I'm here for, and urge his or her support for whatever. Definitely you should do
that. Even if you aren't in the office, if you just leave a note that you've done this?
Anything like that, any way you can personally connect with them. I was meeting with your colleagues. I was going to say, I'm surprised how many times people don't do that. They're there to testify on an issue, not because they're the head of the Minnesota Sheriff's Association or something, but because they're somebody with expertise or some concern, or they met with legislators who have similar views on an issue in a strategy meeting or something. Then go and talk to the legislators who you should have a contact with because they're yours. All of that makes this very good sense to do that, and a lot of times people don't think about that, but it makes sense to. Yes?
There's a lot of power in coalitions in Oregon. We wanted to get early intervention through, so if you have a child with mental retardation, from the point of identification on to 21, do we get support? And the federal kicked in at 6, so we got together with people in mental health, ARC Association for Retarded Citizens, some educators, local district that was aligned, and a group of parents. I coordinated the parents, and we went in to testify. And what the politicians heard were these four groups from very different perspectives advocating for the same thing in a coherent, intelligent way. And the legislation passed, and was subsequently used as a basis for the federal legislation. So that coordinating between different groups to align can be very, very powerful.
So in the same way, one group has more clout than one individual, there's obviously more. In that sort of case where you can build a coalition, you know, on a lot of issues you have different groups who perhaps for different reasons or different concerns come together and support something, and some groups have a lot of respect, some groups are more noisy and get attention and may have clout through that, but other groups may just be a good resource and people trust them, and sometimes you can get some groups that are just very politically active and very noisy in that sense. Not literally noisy, but noisy enough to get attention, along with some of the groups that are the respected nonprofits or business groups or whatever that people turn to for information. You get them together working in coalition, you can have a very powerful thing. And then again, that doesn't mean to stop doing the visits to local legislators. You get that coalition, and you probably, if you were organizing parents, you try and get parents around the state to contact their local legislators. This is a concern. Yes.
In congregations, I think I'll speak for ourselves, we find ourselves often advocating for those who typically don't vote, homeless, people in lower socioeconomic areas, and so the pressure of the vote doesn't come with our lobbying.
In other words, if you don't do what we want,
there's
people are going to vote against you.
Yeah, there's no pressure from that. So the pressure, you know, talk about persuasion and pressure. I find myself at times when I know there's no persuasion that the person I'm dealing with, county, state, whatever, they may not agree with that position, but they're quick to say now, but don't go to the press, we don't want any pressure on this, that'll sour the deal even before
sour we sour the deal, yes.
Yeah, that's
keep
right.
Quiet.
That's right,
yeah.
Keep quiet. You know, when that's the face-to-face initial response, you know, well, let's kind of just talk amongst ourselves and not get this public. Is it fair to try to build some more coalitions and put a little more public pressure on when you're feeling like, going, you know, why don't they want more people to know about this? You know, especially because the constituents we're working for are voiceless.
Two comments. Don't let me forget the second part of this. But the first part about the fact that you don't have any ability to put pressure on because you're dealing with people who don't vote. Well, certainly the people from your congregation who are raising the issue vote, and there's some at least sense of there are a lot of people concerned about this, and you should. The other thing you got going for you is the fact that there are people who are doing this because they think it's the right thing to do. I'm not doing this because it's going to help me, I'm doing this because of that. And frankly, the fact that you care about somebody else, I think with a lot of public officials is a real positive point and worth doing. And you should make that point, and you should say, I'm not doing this on my behalf. It's housing issues. I'm fine, my housing situation is not a problem, but look, these are people who we've worked with in our congregation, they're working, they can't afford housing, or whatever the situation is, educating and saying we're concerned because of them, and they're not able to do this, they're too much struggling to keep their own lives together, here's why, or chemical dependency or something, they're unable to speak for themselves, they're voiceless in that way. I think a lot of people, that's a plus. The other part of your question, and now I'm blanking on
pressure.
The pressure.
The press.
Oh, don't talk to anybody else. Just keep this quiet or you'll sour the deal. I hate that sort of talk. And I'd say be extremely leery when somebody's telling, oh, don't talk to anybody about this because then maybe we can just secretly do something. You know, if you don't sense they're on your side on the issue, they're probably not doing it to help you. They're doing it because, hey, you know, they're afraid that if everybody else gets upset, riled up about this, that maybe their position is going to look pretty bad. if they're telling you that, I mean, I think the reasonable thing to say is, look, you know, I want to see some action here. I don't care who all knows or doesn't know, but I just want to see the action. Now, why is this going to hurt to do this? And you can have others, if you feel for some reason you can't talk with the media or something, have others do it. And I mean, it seems to me that that's a good indication that probably the best thing to do is bring attention to the issue. Unless you think they really are willing to do this if they don't have a lot of something else, I'd be extremely leery of that kind of thing. Let's keep this all secret and then it'll all turn out better than otherwise. It seems to me that they're scared that you might talk to somebody and build some political pressure. So I wouldn't say, hey, just because you don't want us to talk about it doesn't mean we should talk about it. We feel committed to changing it. We'll do whatever we can to change it because we think it's the right thing to do. There's some up there that I'll get back to you. Yes?
I'm concerned about the misuse of my personal information. What's to prevent a state or even a federal legislator from selling my personally identifiable information to, say, a third-party marketer or something?
Okay. I was going to say the biggest concern I'd have about public official you contact doing it would be, and it's prohibited, I believe, under federal law for congressional, U.S. Senate, and Congress offices using correspondence that you write them, taking any of their office correspondence addresses or anything else and using it for campaign purposes. And at state level, boy, I see people, I mean, our Senate has sent people, since we've gotten computers in the last 10, 12, 15 years, things, if you have your constituent stuff and you want that loaded onto a disk from constituent mailings, you want that loaded onto a disk for this, you have to do it within this period of time under our laws, otherwise it'll show up as a campaign expenditure contribution. From whom? The state of Minnesota? I was going to say, I find it really troubling that people take those lists and use it for campaigns. I don't think it's a very likely scenario that a legislator or politician is going to sell your list to a marketer. I think it's a big problem that state government agencies do so, and in Minnesota it's been a fight for 10, 12 years to try and stop them from doing it. And frankly, the whole issue of privacy, this is not a talk about issues, but I was going to say one of my colleagues did a survey, and I'm not sure how accurate those surveys are. It's who takes the time to respond, it's not scientific. But I was sitting next to him in a committee meeting, and he was showing me, look, John, here, this privacy one, do you think businesses should be able to share your personal financial data with others for marketing or whatever purposes without your consent? Well, it's like 2,000 no and about 12 yes. I mean, it was not like it was a close call. I was going to say, that's the way I feel about it. But I frankly think most people I know kind of find it offensive that they're using this information without it. That's a separate and a hot issue. And state government agencies have, at times, our driver and vehicle services for years did that. And they claimed they weren't making money off it. They had to claim that because state law prohibited us from selling lists for more than the cost of putting together the lists. And yet, when we tried to stop them from doing it, they opposed it, saying, well, legitimate things do happen, but I think state governments are getting so much political pressure, they themselves are not, but business community is saying, we need to be able to market these things, and we tell you on the fine print of your credit card agreement or something, item number 34 in the 5-point type, that you can send a letter to post office box so-and-so in Irving, Texas, and we will not sell your name to anybody. I thought, well, how nice, nobody does that. And I think laws ought to be changed on that, but I would not expect that public officials would sell your name to a marketer. I highly doubt that would happen. And I can't guarantee it, but I don't.
It hasn't happened.
Too much risk. You'd have a lot to risk, and it would look pretty funny if they were giving it to your campaign and they can't give it to you. What are they gonna do? Give money to the state? Most public officials aren't trying to get more money for the state by selling lists that would offend a whole lot of people. Did you have one too?
No.
Okay. Others up there? If not, you had another one. Yes.
How effective or what impact does the Lutheran Office of Public Policy have?
Okay. The Lutheran Office of Public Policy, I gotta quit in a minute. The Lutheran Office of Public Policy, and somehow this issue came up in a previous discussion, because they mainly work at the federal level, I can't tell you, I would have a feeling they have some impact. It's another organization out there. They're limited on the number of issues they do because of which ones the church body agrees to. And church bodies, I've seen cases where they can have where legislators, politicians are more interested because it's the church and they respect it and see it as nonpartisan and so on. I've also seen cases where, we have a former Lutheran bishop who's a constituent of mine who comes every time we have a gambling issue, and he feels strongly about it. And he speaks from the heart on why he thinks we shouldn't be expanding gambling, or his pet peeve that the state advertises to promote gambling, and the state's addicted to gambling revenue now and everything else. He makes a passionate case, and there's always one legislator who disagrees with him who says, well, how come so many of your church people are gambling? And he says, well, we're all a bunch of sinners. So the church is not always seen, just because the church says something doesn't mean a church body says something, doesn't mean it's overwhelmingly accepted. It is one more group and one more thing. That helps how effective we have similar state types of things. Catholic bishops in our state are fairly active, and unlike their constituents who say, as a Catholic, it's always on the abortion issue, Catholic bishops, well, that's one of 20 points they're always concerned about. A lot of them on economic issues. I would say a lot of their membership is not aware of all the issues they talk about. But I do think they draw some attention and some positive attention to their issues. So anyway, any one last question? I think we got about a minute or two, but up there, yes.
I don't know if you've had any experience yourself trying to mobilize congregations on an issue or not. How would you respond to often when you try to talk about any political issue within the church, people get really hesitant or back off or don't want to deal with it or think it's too volatile because it's political?
Right. As one who, when I do political mobilizing, it's usually either on my campaign for my own elections, or if it's on an issue, I'm trying to do it with the broader public. I'm not trying to go to church bodies or congregations. I mean, that's always a difficult one, because I think the church feels it is supposed to speak to a lot of things that society deals with. And the church feels strongly it ought to be involved in that. The church also recognizes that it has a lot of people who don't agree on a lot of issues, which is why church bodies tend to take, relatively speaking, smaller number of public policy statements than a lot of members may want them to, just because there's disagreements among them. I think it's very healthy for congregations to discuss these things. I don't know that discussion doesn't always mean you're going to all come to an agreement, even an overwhelming consensus that we want to get involved in this issue as a group. But I think we all benefit. The more we can get congregations talking about these issues and trying to figure out what perspectives, I did a talk on faith and politics last week, and I don't think the church should be trying to say, this scripture proves this, but I think we should be trying to say, here's things we're concerned, we as Christians, that we're supposed to be concerned about the poor, the vulnerable, the oppressed. We're supposed to be speaking for the voiceless. And it doesn't tell us how we're supposed to do it and on what ways we should address injustice. It just says that we're supposed to be concerned about this, and maybe using that and those concerns and getting the congregations to discuss it, I think it's a very positive thing to do. Anyway, I think we are out of time. I appreciate your attendance. I hope this is helpful, because it was meant to be a how-to session, and I hope it helps in that way. Thank you.